This is Faith Ignited, the podcast where we put God back into history.
Episode 17, Love Stronger Than Death. Audrey-Anne wrung her hands nervously, only separating them long enough to brace herself against the walls of the lavish royal carriage when the wheels encountered a rut in the road. She could feel the gaze of the queen sitting opposite her on the velvet cushions. Marie Antoinette seemed to be reveling in the excitement of it all, her rosy youthful cheeks glowing. Audrey-Anne and the queen had been in close association for several years. They were only a few years apart in age, after all, but their natures were entirely opposite. Whereas Marie was vivacious, bold, and loud, Audrey-Anne was quiet, reserved, and often sober. Marie peered out the window to check their location, her ostentatious gown crinkling with the movement, as she sent another eager look toward Audrey-Anne. Crowds still filled the streets, and the roads themselves had been clean swept in celebration of the birth of the new Dauphin. King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette had finally had a son, and all of Paris was celebrating. But that was not the only thing to cause all of the excitement. Audrey-Anne and her family had been at the Queen's celebration when word had spread like wildfire from the docks all the way to the gala. From mouth to mouth, the news finally reached Audrey-Anne that Lafayette had returned in victory from America. After more than a year and a half away, he'd finally come back. Audrey-Anne had instantly wanted to abandon the entire celebration and rush home to her husband, but protocol had prohibited it. No one could leave before the queen herself, and after that, the other dignitaries would follow her carriage in a slow procession. But when word had reached Marie Antoinette, she had, realizing Audrey-Anne's predicament, marched through the crowd and told her to go immediately to her husband. Shyly, Audrey-Anne had tried to tell her that she did not want to break etiquette, to which the queen had smiled and proposed another solution. She would simply alter her route and deliver Audrey-Anne to Lafayette herself. It was a thoughtful gesture, if somewhat spurred by the queen's own desire to take part in the dramatic scene. But Audrey-Anne was just grateful not to have to wait another several more agonizing hours to see her Gilbert. Just thinking about him made her heart feel as though someone had wrapped their hand around it and squeezed. Her father had originally proposed the marriage, as well as a marriage for her older sister, but her mother was far too protective to agree to such a young marriage to a young man that she didn't even know. Not that it was uncommon for such arrangements. Many of the noble class met their future spouses on their wedding day. But Audrey-Anne's mother had always been different in her approach to parenting. She'd not sent her children away for schooling. Instead, she'd hired a governess and acted as their principal teacher herself. For weeks, Audrey-Anne's parents had debated over the issue of their daughters' marriages, neither yielding, while Audrey-Anne and her siblings didn't understand the often chilly environment that had invaded their home. Finally, Audrey-Anne's mother agreed, under the conditions that the marriage be postponed for 2 years, that the young couple live with them for the first part of their marriage, and that both she and Audrey-Anne have the opportunity to meet the young Marquis de Lafayette before the wedding. Audrey-Anne still remembered the first time she'd laid eyes on him. They would meet haphazardly, either at her home or on walks, something that she learned later was not coincidence. And though her mother had never mentioned him as a potential husband for her, Audrey-Anne had found herself hopelessly smitten with him. Some found him shy or awkward, but she never had. And Audrey-Anne had been overjoyed when her mother later confided that they'd already signed a marriage contract between them. Her mother's protests had pushed their marriage back until Audrey-Anne was 14 and Gilbert 16. Her mother adored Gilbert. Even when he'd run off to America, she'd never believed him to have anything but the most honorable and noble of motivations. Since then, Audrey-Anne had done her best to do as Lafayette had exhorted her and become a good American, the dutiful wife of an American major general. But oh, how terribly she'd missed him. He was a hero, and there was a price to pay as a hero's wife. Still, she was so proud of him. She could still picture the great philosopher and historian Voltaire himself, seeking her out and falling to his knees before her and saying, I wish to present my homage to the wife of the hero of the new world. May I live long enough to salute him as the liberator of the old. She'd offered up countless prayers for his safe return. And the year that he'd spent in Paris before he'd left again for America had been almost magical, and deepened the far more tentative affection they'd felt the first several years of their marriage. She'd always loved him, but now she loved him so completely and wholly that she ached to be apart from him. And now he'd finally returned. As the carriage tottered down the cobblestone streets, she leaned forward to view her family's large estate appearing in the distance. Anticipation tied her stomach into knots. Large crowds had gathered to witness the reunion, many still filtering in from the streets. The ornate coach pulled to a halt in front of the stately home. A shout rang out at the sight of the queen, but was redoubled when the gathering saw Marie Antoinette's passenger guest. No doubt having heard the uproar caused by the queen's arrival, Gilbert had already sprinted to the gate, shoving his way to the front of the crowd. Marie Antoinette leaned out, smiling as she extended a hand for him to kiss. "I want to congratulate you on your victory in America," she said in her strong Austrian accent. She glanced over at Adrienne, adding, "As you see, I have brought you Madame de Lafayette. Her place today is not with me, but with her husband." Adrienne was helped out of the opposite side of the carriage, and as the coach moved, she stared speechless at her husband, so overcome with emotion that she couldn't speak. All the fear, the long nights spent not knowing if he would ever come back, came crashing down in that moment. She took a step forward, but stumbled. Her legs gave out from beneath her. Gilbert rushed forward to catch her, swooping her up in his arms as she fainted. The crowd went wild at the emotional display, while Gilbert carried his wife inside the house, her head crumpling against his shoulder as her long skirts trailed on the ground. Adrienne regained consciousness in her father's house. She was embarrassed by her fainting spell and scolded herself for not retaining her composure enough to give him a proper welcome. But as she stared up at her husband, clad in his American uniform, looking older than his 24 years with his red hair already starting to recede and his green eyes watching her tenderly, she reached up to touch his cheek to assure herself that he was real. Her Gilbert had come home. There are two basic disciplines that govern the process of education. They are the humanities and the sciences. Humanities cover subjects like art, literature, and philosophy, and the sciences include mathematics, astronomy, biology, etc. The thing that makes these disciplines different is their approach to learning. The sciences are rigid and strictly guided by data and objectivity. Art, on the other hand, is a lot more subjective. It's guided by feelings, opinions, or beliefs. There's not really a right or a wrong way to do art, because its value is based on the opinion of the observer. But math and science are not that way. If you get a different answer to a calculus problem than somebody else, one of you got it wrong. There's only one right answer, and a lot of wrong answers. You need to learn the rules and follow them precisely to get a desired result. Which is why I find it fascinating that politics fall into the category of the sciences. A big problem that we see today is that people think everything is subjective, that truth is subjective. But when it comes to politics, certain forms of government work and others just don't. And those who have chosen to steer from the data of what actually creates happy, free societies have been some of the foremost in history to wreak havoc on this world. And almost every problem in society stems from a violation of God's eternal laws. John Adams called politics the divine science, and author Cleon Skousen wrote that, "Just as scientists seek to learn the divine principles by which God rules the universe, so students of political science should seek to discover the divine principles for the most ideal human government, which would propel mankind toward a blessed age of peace on earth, goodwill toward men." John Adams looked upon his own generation as a core of modern political scientists who had a mission to identify and revive the divine principles of sound politics revealed by God in ancient times. Philosophers such as William Blackstone, John Locke, as well as nearly every American founding father, believed that the greatest textbook for political or divine science was the Bible. There you could learn about the system of government that God himself had set up, and the principles that governed those societies. In the previous episode, we discussed Lafayette's role in the American Revolution, and now we're going to experience the French Revolution through the eyes of his family. It really is quite remarkable that the American and French revolutions happened just a few years apart, but the results were astoundingly different. One produced the longest-standing constitution the world has ever seen, with some of the greatest freedom and prosperity experienced by any people in history, and the other descended into an evil far more corrupt and diabolical than the government that they originally sought to overthrow. How is that even possible? Well, let's try to unfold this mystery and find the answer. The dominating philosophy in 18th century Europe was something called the Divine Right of Kings, which was basically the idea that God had sanctioned the station of every living person, from the king down to the lowest of the peasants. No moving up the social ladder. And that remained a practically unquestioned philosophy until 1776, when the Declaration of Independence crushed that idea with words like, all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. This defiance of the divine right to rule splashed icy water in the faces of the world leaders, who feared that such an idea might spread. In many ways, Lafayette was the conduit of this idea from the New World to the Old. His second return after the surrender of Cornwallis was heralded by all of France. He came back and found the court at his feet. Everyone wanted to meet the friend of Washington and the conqueror of Cornwallis. As you can imagine, Audrienne was overjoyed to have him home again. Their daughter Virginie wrote, "For many months after his return, she actually felt ill every time he left their room, fearing that he might go back to war and she would never see him again." I'm telling you this because in the last episode we discussed what Lafayette gave for the American cause, but we should not overlook the fact that there was no sacrifice that he made that did not require the sacrifice of his loving and faithful wife, Audrienne. She stood by him from the beginning, trusting him, believing in him and his cause. The fact that Audrienne and Lafayette even ended up married in the first place is in and of itself a miracle. What other two people in all of France would have had their same ideals, beliefs, and character? Especially coming from the upper class. The 18th century French aristocracy wasn't exactly known for producing crusaders of liberty. But somehow, these two extraordinary people came together through an arranged marriage. And Audrienne is no passive onlooker in this story. She alone knew the kind of fear that accompanied a husband fighting in a foreign war thousands of miles away. The type of pain it was to lose a child and not have her husband there to support her. But little did she know that this was only the beginning of their story, and that the fear she'd known was a prelude to the terror that was about to reign. When Lafayette came back to Paris, he, for the first time ever, was able to see to his own personal affairs. He and Audrienne finally purchased their own home. Their estate became the center for American-French politics, having a revolving door when it came to Americans and dignitaries alike. American flags and trinkets were spread conspicuously throughout the house, and a large painting of George Washington held a place of honor on a prominent wall. In Lafayette's study, he had a gold-lettered copy of the Declaration of Independence that he would read whenever he, quote, wished to put myself in good spirits. The Lafayette children were raised speaking English as well as they spoke French. And unlike many parents, who kept their children at arm's length with the idea that children were to be seen and not heard, the Lafayettes poured out love, praise, and affection constantly on their children, and would have them sing and perform their talents for any audience, no matter how grand. But while things were looking up for the Lafayette family, things were not at all well in France. There were storm clouds gathering on the horizon. Gilbert stepped out of the carriage, gazing up at the structure that he'd called home for the first 11 years of his life. It was just before dusk, and he could still make out the turrets of the old chateau. Pleasant memories floated through his mind. He hadn't been back since his training for knighthood 10 years previous, before he'd ever left for America. He was not even close to the same young man that he'd been then, and it felt strange and nostalgic to be standing on the same soil of his youth. And he was soon to discover that he was not the only thing that had changed over the passage of time. As he came inside, Gilbert glanced around at the familiar walls. Then finally, after coming through the entryway and entering one of the adjoining rooms, his eyes landed on his Aunt Charlotte, aged a great deal and looking very frail. His grandmother had passed away as well as one of his aunts, leaving his remaining Aunt Charlotte alone. When she saw him, tears erupted from her sullen eyes, sobs escaping her throat. Gilbert hadn't expected to see her so entirely overcome by emotion, and was almost frightened by her anguished cries. She finally pulled herself together, wiping at the tears as he watched her with concern and sympathy. When he'd returned from Spain and heard of the devastation caused by the famine in this region, he'd come to see for himself what was happening. But he hadn't expected to find his aunt in such a dreadful state. His beloved Audrienne had already begun doing what she could to aid the people. She'd provided the peasants with enough grain to survive the winter, and even had a spinning and weaving mill built so the women could weave the wool from their husbands' sheep into cloth that they might sell as a more permanent solution to the poverty. She'd even ordered a school be erected to teach the women how to weave. He smiled just thinking about how immensely proud he was of her wisdom, foresight, and generosity. It was why he trusted her so completely to make such decisions regarding their finances. The next day, as the sun spread over the green hills, Gilbert peered out the window. It seemed that word had spread of his return to the area, because near the chateau gates, crowds were gathering. Terribly gaunt and dirty peasants, staring up at the chateau with eager anticipation. It was a disheartening sight. As Gilbert came outside, he was stunned to recognize among the faces some of the boys that he'd known and played with during his childhood days. He was again struck by how much had changed. These were not the people pulling off their hats and waving as he and his grandmother rode past. These were mere shadows of those happy people, eaten away by fear and want. As he approached, many fell to their knees in front of him, begging for food, clothing, or money. "They're going to evict us," one man said. "We haven't been able to pay rent because of the taxes and the famine." Gilbert's heart constricted, unable to bear the wailing and sunken eyes of the children. Something had to be done. As he met with his overseers, Gilbert asked, "What is the state of my granaries?" "Your granaries are stocked to overflowing," one of the men assured. Gilbert nodded at this. "Good. I want it all dispensed to the people." They looked taken aback. "All of it?" "Yes, all of it." Brows drawn in consternation, one of the overseers responded, "Are you sure this is advisable? Why would you want to open your granaries and dispense the grain for no cost? With prices so high, this is an ideal time to sell." Gilbert's blood grew hot. "No," he said sternly. "This is the best time to give it away." He might not have had control over all of France, but he was still master over this province according to French feudal laws, and he intended to reduce the suffering in any way he had power to do so. The beginning of the French Revolution can be traced back to three basic things. First, the starvation of the people, spurred by famine and overtaxation. Second, raging unemployment. And third, the unrestrained spending of the crown. There came a point where the monarchy was bankrupt, and the king realized that taxing the lower class was not solving the issue. You can only squeeze an empty tube so much. And so he assembled something called the Assembly of Notables, which was basically a council representing the wealthiest classes that gathered to discuss how to solve the financial problems in France. The king wanted to start taxing some of the wealthier classes, but the aristocrats were unwilling to submit to any taxes unless the crown was willing to curb its spending. The chant rang out, "No reforms, no taxes." This created an ineffective tug-of-war that raged on for months while peasants were starving in the streets, their plight becoming more and more desperate. Lafayette was bright-eyed and enthusiastic coming out of the American Revolution. Some of the things that he wanted to implement in France were religious liberty. Keep in mind that the church was an extension of the government in France, so anything outside of Roman Catholicism was illegal. He also wanted to abolish slavery, and to see equal rights and opportunities for the lower class, who were being crushed under heavy taxes. These goals led him to draft the document, The Rights of Man, with the help of Thomas Jefferson, which is why it has a familiar ring with some similar wording to the Declaration of Independence. But Lafayette hoped that this document could be a sort of constitution for France. In fact, his goal was to create a constitutional monarchy, similar to what we have in America, but with a king instead of a president. But he ran into some massive roadblocks along the way. The reforms that Lafayette proposed to give Protestants rights and end slavery were constantly shot down. As Lafayette would observe to Washington, most of the notables were not ables who belonged to, quote, a bigoted party of anti-Protestants and wicked people who opposed reform. As Harlow Giles Unger put it, unlike American notables at Philadelphia, French notables did not gather in Versailles to pledge their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, but to preserve the first and enhance the second. And of the few with honor, none held it too sacred to sell at the right price. So Lafayette was an honorable man surrounded by a lot of corruption. This gap between the aristocrats and the lower class was a massive chasm to try and breach. The aristocrats were throwing lavish parties in their estates, while the lower class were starving in the streets. The French government began printing money in an attempt to pay off their debts, which just sent prices soaring. Thousands were laid off from their jobs. Jefferson wrote to Adams saying, "The king, long in the habit of drowning his cares in wine, plunges deeper and deeper. The queen cries, but sins on." As the situation worsened, hungry people began banding together. Pamphlets were circulating all around France, denouncing the monarchy and calling for the people to take power. Unger described the situation like this. Mobs of peasants and impoverished workers raided church-owned granaries, wheat convoys, and bakeries in every town and city. Mobs swarmed through the streets. Thieves broke into homes to steal anything made of gold or silver to trade for food. Pamphleteers flooded Paris with leaflets accusing Versailles and the aristocracy of starving the nation into submission. As France reeled violently amid the demands for popular rule, the United States walked calmly and firmly toward the end, meaning the end of their revolution. Around this time, Gouverneur Morris, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, arrived in France. Morris predicted that Lafayette's efforts to introduce American-style republicanism in France would result either in tyranny or anarchy. But Lafayette still pressed forward. In many ways, his love for his nation and its people blinded him to their fatal flaws. But Morris saw things more clearly. He wrote to Washington saying that the widespread, quote, depravity would put Lafayette's endeavors in jeopardy. He went on to say, "The great mass of the common people have no religion but their priests, no law but their superiors, no moral but their interest. These are the creatures who, led by drunken charades, are now in the high road à la liberté, and the first use they make of it is to form insurrections everywhere for the want of bread." Upon hearing what was happening in the streets, the king asked Lafayette's cousin, the Duc de Liancourt, "Then it is a full-blown riot?" "No," Liancourt answered. "It is a full-blown revolution." Gilbert felt the sun on his face as he bounced atop his white horse along the River Seine. The water flowed peacefully, a sharp contrast to the troubled state of his mind. Anarchy. That was the word that described the recent state of affairs in Paris. The people were growing more agitated and violent with every day that passed. Gilbert himself had been the first to call for a national assembly that would allow all classes to be equally represented, which the king had initially refused, but against the king's wishes, the national assembly had been formed. At first, it seemed like a great triumph, especially considering Gilbert's new position as commanding general and military leader of the new government. But it was becoming increasingly difficult to tell the difference between the triumphs and the challenges of this revolution. Already, great changes were underway, but they seemed to be accompanied by nothing but debauchery. Gilbert alone seemed to be able to control the behavior of the people, the fury building to a peak until he would arrive, and with a word from him, the people would disperse. Once he charged in on his horse, moving the crowd like the parting of the Red Sea to save the life of a priest. Gilbert had repeated the process several times throughout the day, demanding the release of those the mob was about to hang or butcher in the street. But he could not be everywhere all at once. Gilbert may have managed to maintain some degree of order in Paris, but there was nothing to hinder them in other parts of France. Just then, as Gilbert rode through the streets, he saw a carriage surrounded by a horde of people, carrying pikes, rope, and whatever other weapon they'd managed to get their hands on. The mob had stopped the carriage, and Gilbert watched as they dragged an elderly man from the coach. They began marching him to City Hall. Lafayette recognized him as Foulon, a financier appointed by the king, who'd made some disparaging remark about the Parisians, and it was clear that the mob was out for blood. Hot indignation surged through him. Gilbert raced forward to stop the carnage. He plunged into the crowd, crying out, "You want to kill this man without a judgment?" He gazed around in absolute disgust at the crowd. "That," he continued, "is an injustice which dishonors you and me, and will tarnish all of my efforts for liberty, if I were so weak as to permit it. I will not permit it. I will not save him if he is guilty, but I want him tried by a judge before a tribunal according to law." His chest was heaving now, his words coming with great force. "I demand respect for the law, without which there is no liberty, without which I would not have supported the revolution in the New World, and without which I will not support the revolution here." His impassioned speech suitably calmed the crowd, allowing him to escort the shaken Foulon into the Hotel de Ville. The man's entire body still trembled with fear. Gilbert had hardly had time to escort the old man to a seat, however, when the door suddenly burst open. The re-energized crowd spilled inside, seizing Foulon's arms and dragging him back into the street. "Stop this at once," Lafayette ordered, but the people paid him no heed. Totally helpless to control them, Lafayette watched in horror as the man was hung from a street lamppost, his body still convulsing as another mob brought his son-in-law, who'd been trying to flee Paris, to meet his end at the same place as his father-in-law. The crowd tore the man apart. Heads were placed on spikes as the people marched their trophies through the streets. From his window, Gilbert could see the hideous face of the lawyer Georges Danton, the instigator of this and so many other heinous deeds in the Paris streets. Danton had despised Gilbert ever since he'd publicly humiliated him by ordering the lawyer to turn in his elector's sword, marching him up the steps to the city hall after thwarting a hanging that the lawyer had instigated. Danton watched the slaughter with savage delight. Gilbert felt complete, utter revulsion. He'd never witnessed anything like this in America. This was deprivation at its core, and he suddenly understood Morris's warning about unleashing but not having anything to check the people's passions. The people had lost their humanity, and he had lost his control over them. There were countless scenes like the one I just related in the French Revolution, except I toned it down a lot. And strangely enough, the guillotine was actually invented in an attempt to make a more humane way of killing people, instead of what was happening in the streets. After this incident, Lafayette attempted to resign. He felt that he no longer had any control over the people, so there was no point. The assembly was stunned. They knew that no liberty would ever be successfully implemented without Lafayette. So in desperation, they offered to give submission to all of his orders, basically appointing him military dictatorship powers in Paris, and also offered him an enormous salary. With some hesitancy, Lafayette retained his position, but he refused the money. Like Washington, he was not doing it for the pay. And for a time, Lafayette had some success in establishing a degree of order in Paris, but it did not last. All of the good that Lafayette was trying to implement kept being undermined by lawyers like Danton and Robespierre. each of them lit fires wherever Lafayette put them out, inciting and unleashing the wrath of the people. Things were becoming increasingly dangerous for Lafayette and his family. Virginie wrote, "Not once in those days did she, her mother, see him leave the house without the feeling that she might be saying her adieu to him for the last time." At one point, a massive mob broke into the palace intent on beheading the monarchs. Lafayette charged in, arriving just in time to save their lives, acting as their guardian angel, as Jefferson put it. But it was pretty obvious that the king's authority was gone. It had been replaced by the will of the people. And unfortunately, the populace could not distinguish between revenge and justice. When the National Assembly met to form a new government, they at first wanted Lafayette to act as president of the assembly, but he refused the position. He wasn't looking for power or prestige, but unfortunately, his absence left the new government ripe for corruption from men who were incredibly power-hungry, who maintained the support of the people by encouraging them to indulge in their passions and hatred. Madmen, as Morris called them, Robespierre Danton and Jean-Paul Marat, seized control and ushered in what history would call the Reign of Terror. In 1790, the new assembly abolished the Roman Catholic Church, creating a new deist state church, which required all to take an oath to the new government. Then in 1793, they enacted something called the Law of Suspects, which implemented the following measures. First, all priests and all persons protecting them are liable to death on the spot. Second, the destruction of all crosses, bells, and all other external signs of worship. And third, the destruction of statues, plaques, and iconography from places of worship. They also replaced the Christian calendar with one that reckoned from the date of the revolution instead of the birth of Christ. That's one thing that most people don't know about the French Revolution, was the massive de-Christianization that took place. In fact, during the Reign of Terror, anti-clericalism became more violent than in any other period of history. Now here is the heart of what makes the American and French revolutions different. The patriots in America and their leaders were largely very religious. They weren't just fighting for freedom from taxation, they were fighting for religious liberty. They had originally separated themselves from England because of the issue of government getting too involved in religion and trying to make them the same entity. France had the exact same problem, but instead of propagating and purifying religion, they took the exact opposite approach. They, associating religion with the monarchy, wanted to do away with it and faith in God altogether. There was this mentality of not answering to anyone, whether that was an earthly king or a heavenly one. And this spread a massive wave of secularization that took hold in France. Most scholars would agree that the real motivation behind the French Revolution ranged from an attempt to reclaim all land, power, and funds from the church and monarchy, to the outright extinction of religion itself. But it's pretty obvious that their rejection of God led to nothing but darkness and bondage. These developments were especially troubling to Adrienne and her family. Her father was an atheist, but she and her mother were deeply religious. Adrienne openly defied the new religious laws. Her daughter wrote, "Instead, she went regularly to churches and chapels where the persecuted clergy had taken refuge and continued to preach. She constantly welcomed into her home refusés priests and their parishioners who were fleeing persecution and asked for our protection. She encouraged them to continue preaching and to fight for the freedom to practice their religion. My father did not for a moment consider interfering with her, but you can imagine how painful it was to my mother to realize how much her actions were eroding his popularity. But as things got more dangerous, Adrienne's conviction and strength would be tested to her very core." Adrienne stared up at the ceiling of her cell, forcing herself to remain calm. Other than the cot on which she was lying and some chains stretched out on the floor, there was nothing else in the dreary room. She'd recently been moved from the house of detention where she'd spent the past 6 months to the common jail, but she knew that her stay here would be brief. It was merely an in-between before she was sent to a prison in Paris. The past 6 months had certainly been challenging. Her welcome from her fellow prisoners at the Brioude prison hadn't initially been a warm one. Some had refused to speak to the wife of Lafayette. They saw his actions in the revolution as a cause of their current suffering. But over time, as Audrianne had acted as a nurse to many of the elderly sick and had cooked for the invalids, they'd softened their opinion of her. Some of the lower-class prisoners had taken to her immediately, especially a baker's wife, a deeply religious woman with whom she'd become close friends. But even the higher-ranking prisoners had come to respect her over time. And when she'd left, many had grieved to see her go. But the greatest comfort to Audrianne were the visits from her children. George Washington's tutor, Felix Verstel, who'd been a godsend in their time of trial, had arranged for secret visits between her and her children more than once. They usually took place at night, the children being led inside by a jailer that Verstel had bribed. Sometimes their visits lasted hours, but more often, they only had time for a quick embrace in the dark and a few whispered words that wouldn't alert the other prisoners nearby. Through those visits, she'd been able to get word of her mother and sister imprisoned in Paris, where she was now bound herself. The anxiety over her family was now coupled by the uncertainty of her own fate. Audrianne tried to clamp down her fear. She was only being transferred, she reminded herself, not called to stand before a revolutionary tribunal. But still she knew that what likely awaited her in Paris was the guillotine. Being a woman would in no way thwart execution. Just a few months previous, Marie Antoinette had made the walk to the guillotine herself, 9 months after her husband King Louis XVI. Suddenly Audrianne heard the bolts of her cell door sliding out of place. She sat upright, her head turning toward the door. It opened, and her children rushed inside. Her oldest daughter, Anastasie, was crying hysterically as she threw her arms around Audrianne. Her other daughter, Virginie, and her son, George Washington, gathered around her as well, huddling together on the floor. Verstel stood watching, his eyes tired, but his back straight, and his face set in a calm and determined expression. What would they have done without him? Gilbert himself had once commented that Verstel was like a member of the family, and he had proved himself to be just that. As they began discussing plans, it was decided that Verstel would follow Audrianne to Paris and try and garner the aid of the American ambassador, Gouverneur Morris. "I won't be left behind," Anastasie interjected. "I want to go with you too." Audrianne hesitated, not wanting her daughter in danger, but Anastasie was so overwrought by the thought of their separation that she finally consented. Anastasie's grief instantly turned to joy, and she immediately left with Verstel to obtain the necessary traveling permit, leaving Audrianne alone with her other two children. She gathered George and Virginie up next to her, holding them close. As she stroked their hair, looking down into their frightened faces, she desperately wished that she could spare them from all they were being called to pass through. She'd shielded them as much as possible, but it seemed that it was her children's lot to be exposed to the cruelty and evil of men while still in the dawn of their lives. It made her heart ache, but she held them close, treasuring their nearness. She moved to her knees, the children doing the same as they prayed together on the cold cell floor. She then charged George Washington to look after his aunt and rise up to his responsibilities as the man in the family. He was barely a teenager and yet being called to bear so much. Gilbert, after all, was a fugitive now. Considered a traitor by Robespierre in the Assembly, he'd fled to the border, but was detained and arrested in Austria and sent to a prison in Prussia. She'd thought of him constantly, wondering if he was suffering terribly in prison there. Where was he at this very moment? At noon, the post-chaise arrived at the prison, and Audrianne knew it was time to say goodbye. Tears blurred her vision as she embraced them one final time, offering her parting instructions to them. "If I should die," she directed the words mostly to George Washington, "you and your sisters must make every effort to find your father in Germany and set him free. Do you understand?" George nodded gravely, fear and uncertainty reflected in his eyes. As they left, Audrianne tried to keep her composure. God willing, she and her family would somehow come back together again. While Adrienne was being carted off to Paris, Lafayette was being transferred to another prison called Olmütz, a place with far worse conditions than the first prison where he'd been detained. Once Robespierre and his group of extremists called the Jacobins had seized complete and total control in France, they destroyed any semblance of the liberty and constitutional law that Lafayette and those who supported him sought to implement. They roared, "Down with Lafayette!" Robespierre himself stood, signaled everyone to be silent, then proclaimed, "Lafayette is the most dangerous enemy of France. Smite Lafayette and the nation is saved." They began spreading disparaging pamphlets about Lafayette in the streets, demoralizing him in every way they could, and calling him a traitor. Finally, there came a point where Lafayette didn't even have control of his own men, who up to that point had been completely loyal to him. This is what finally led to Lafayette's flight from France. He wrote to Adrienne, urging her to meet him in England, and from there they would go to America. But Lafayette was captured in Austria and sent to a prison in Prussia. The Austrian emperor considered him a radical that had threatened European divine right to rule, and felt that it was only right that he be put in captivity. Meanwhile, Verstel did follow Adrienne to Paris, and then went straight to Gouverneur Morris's home, begging for him to intercede on her behalf. Morris immediately left to plead her case, threatening that if they killed her, they would make an enemy of America. His intercession spared her from the guillotine. Little did Lafayette know that his contributions in America would be the thing that would save his wife's life. She wrote to her children saying, "You must give thanks to God who has spared my life." But unfortunately, Adrienne's mother, grandmother, and sister were not able to escape that fate. Each would be sent to the guillotine. During those days that Adrienne was in prison, executions were happening day in and day out. Crowds gathered to watch and shout their approval at the gruesome scenes. In just 2 years, the French people would send more than 1 million of their own men, women, and children to prisons, and around 200,000 were known to have died, but there were likely many more. In a country of only 26 million, those are some pretty staggering numbers. After paranoia would have Robespierre sending almost anyone associated with him to the guillotine, he would finally meet his ignominious death by the will of the people, and with one of the very guillotine blades that he had used to condemn thousands. Finally, due to some strategic intercession from James Madison, Adrienne was released after 16 months in prison. Now all she cared about was finding her husband. Adrienne strode resolutely through the dark, dank prison halls, clutching her two daughters protectively at her side. George Washington Lafayette had managed to escape with his tutor and was able to secure passage to America. Adrienne had instructed them to seek out the boy's godfather, George Washington, and she sent her son with a letter pleading that Washington take care of her boy until they could be reunited again. The stench of sewage was almost overwhelming to Adrienne's senses. So far, none had been able to influence the emperor to release Gilbert from Olmütz, but Adrienne had finally asked for only one thing, that she be allowed to share his prison cell. The guards led her to a specific door, undoing the bolts and throwing it open. There, in the dark recesses of the cell, sat an emaciated body clothed in small rags that did not cover him entirely. He stared at them in a daze, as if he thought he were dreaming. He looked at her with those familiar green eyes that she loved so dearly. Immediately, Adrienne and the two girls rushed forward, enveloping him in their arms, sobbing as they held each other, not caring about the filth or the stench of the environment. After the soldiers had rummaged through their things and confiscated anything of value, the door slammed shut on their reunion, the bolts sliding back into place. Lafayette would end up spending over 5 years in prison, the last 23 months shared by his wife and daughters. Despite the conditions, they stayed with him, in what truly was a hellish environment. Adrienne, during the last part of their imprisonment, grew gravely ill, but she was told that if she left for treatment, she could not come back. So she chose rather to endure the pain and remain with her husband. Virginie wrote, "Despite her suffering, she seemed happier than she ever had been. It is hard for me to describe how happy she was. To understand, you have to recognize the fear she had lived with for so long. During the frequent separations and endless adventures that took my father away from home into great danger, she had spent the previous 3 horrible years almost without hope of ever finding him again. Now her lifelong dream was fulfilled. Each day she saw the influence of her presence on my father's health and all the comfort her presence provided him. Adrienne gladly and willingly sacrificed her own comforts for her husband's. That is real, true love." Adrienne and Lafayette wanted to go to America, but because America and France were locked in an unofficial war at the time, they were unable to, which in many ways was devastating to them. But they ended up settling in the countryside of France, where George Washington, now 19, returned from America to join them. The family was finally reunited. But their fortune and possessions had been seized during the Revolution. After reclaiming all that they could, they fixed up an old castle called Lagrange, or Lagrange, nicknamed the Mount Vernon of France, and shared several precious years together, watching their family expand as their children married and had children of their own. Virginie wrote of her mother during this period, "The rest of her precious life was consecrated to us. She felt too deep, too passionate a love for family life to want any other type of existence. Neither the grandeur that she had witnessed, nor the fame seen close up, provoked as much happiness as her simple existence. She filled her entire life with love." But Adrienne's health had been greatly affected by her time in prison, and at 48 she became very ill. Lafayette would not leave her bedside. When she urged him to spend some time with the others, he said, "I have nothing else to do but to care for you." Her condition worsened, and she began coming in and out of a comatose sleep. Virginie wrote, "God and my father occupied all her thoughts during those last moments. It is impossible to understand how much she meant to him and he to her. In total silence, their faces were portraits of infinite tenderness and devotion. On Christmas night, at midnight, in the year 1807, we lost her. She had blessed us all that morning. That evening, her last words to us were, 'I am not suffering.' Then she looked at my father and whispered, 'I am yours entirely.'" Lafayette was devastated by her death. He wrote of his grief. "For 34 years of marriage, in which her love, her goodness, the greatness, the tenderness, the goodness of her soul honored my life, I grew so accustomed to all that she was for me that she became an indistinguishable element of my own existence. I knew I loved her a great deal, that I needed her, but it is only in losing her that I have been able to separate myself from what is left of me for the rest of a life which had once seemed to me so full and will now forever be empty of happiness and comfort." When Lafayette was on his deathbed, he was holding a portrait of Adrienne in his hand. The last act of his life was pressing it to his lips, and then he died. Love in our world today is a very misunderstood principle. Many see it as a fleeting emotion, one outside of our control. That's why it becomes so easy for people to fall in and out of love. But the truth is that love is not built by what you gain from a relationship, but by what you give to it. Sacrifice begets love. Why did Lafayette love Adrienne so dearly? Because she sacrificed so much for him. Why did the American people love Lafayette? Because he sacrificed so much on their behalf and expected nothing in return. Both of these are examples of real love, which is not selfish or fleeting. This is unwavering, selfless, godlike love, which is always sacrificial in nature. One of the final things Thomas Jefferson said to Lafayette was, "We shall look upon you always as belonging to us. During the whole of our life, as belonging to our children after us, you are ours by more than patriotic self-devotion with which you flew to the aid of our fathers at the crisis of our fate. By that unshaken gratitude for your services, which is a precious portion of our inheritance, ours by that tie of love stronger than death. which has linked your name for endless generations of time with the name of Washington. The contrast of love and hate is a very powerful theme in this story, and it's easy to see the fruits of both. The French Revolution is really this sad experiment of casting out evil with evil. Instead, they created a more godless, corrupt society than what existed before. As Martin Luther King, a person who knew something about oppression, wrote, "Returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." When you cross the threshold of justice into revenge, there is no satisfaction to be found for that kind of appetite. There must be something to check those passions. Henry Ward Beecher, an American clergyman, said, "There is no liberty to men who know not how to govern themselves. Self-governance consists of self-regulation of our behavior, ambitions, and passions. To this end, the founders fundamentally believed that the ability to govern ourselves rests with our individual and collective virtue, or moral character." And John Adams put it this way, "Neither the wisest constitution nor the wisest laws will secure the liberty and happiness of a people whose manners are universally corrupt. He, therefore, is the truest friend of the liberty of his country who tries most to promote its virtue." Lafayette tried desperately to introduce liberty in France and failed. Not because he spared any effort, but he did learn something, a lesson that's extremely applicable for our time. It is impossible to establish a society of peace, happiness, and freedom with no virtue. So we should be very concerned about the state of our society, because if we reject God, we cannot continue to enjoy freedom. Once His Spirit has no influence, the result is selfishness, hatred, and cruelty. In other words, amorality plus hatred will never add up to liberty. Minusing God from the equation always equals self-destruction. This, my friends, is Divine Science 101. Almost every issue in the world could be fixed if we would just follow the two great commandments, to love God and to love all men. All of the problems that erupted in France, from the aristocrats' oppression of the lower class to the unleashed hatred during the Reign of Terror, all of it could have been avoided if there had simply been love in the hearts of the people. It was God's love for us that proved stronger than death itself. And it's that kind of love that heals nations, connecting us to each other and to God. He is constantly trying to draw us to Him, softening our hearts and igniting our faith.